every single industry will be far better off when men learn from female role models. And part of the problem right now is that many senior men in every industry believe that men have nothing to learn from women, and that men do not see women as role models, and they could not be more wrong.
My name is David Noel. Welcome to the Role Models Podcast, where I interview female role models and ask them about their life and career, about the things they've learned, and about advice they would like to share with the role models community. Our goal is that you hopefully find inspiration and, like I do, learn something from our guests who come from a broad range of backgrounds. Speaking of learning, I learned a lot from my next guest in this episode, who is Cindy Gallup. In fact, I was quite nervous to speak with Cindy, and you can probably hear that in my voice and the way I ask the questions. Because Cindy is a force. She's a former advertising executive turned entrepreneur, public speaker, and consultant. And if you care about diversity, it is very likely that you've come across Cindy and one of her many talks and thoughts on the subject. She's a regular speaker at TED conferences and an active and vocal advocate to make the technology, advertising, and any other industry more diverse. If you want to learn about how to develop your public speaking skills, about what you can do to make your company more gender equal and diverse, about why you should replace the word mentor with the word champion, then this episode is for you. Cindy shares a breadth of insights and advice that you can apply to your life and career right away. Like, for example, her philosophy that a series of micro actions can and will lead to the desired change. This was a fun episode, and I hope you like it too. If you do, please consider giving it a rating and a short review on iTunes. This helps the podcast reach more people like yourself, and I do appreciate your support. So here you go. This is the Role Models Podcast. This is episode 12, and this is Cindy Gallup. Cindy Gallup, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm really excited to have you on the podcast because the past few weeks, I saw your tweets on Twitter and saw that you were at the TED conference in Vancouver, correct?
That's right, yes.
What is the one TED talk that we as an audience can look forward to that you were really excited about?
I'll be honest, my response to that will not necessarily be the kind of TED talk that you're asking about, but undoubtedly, the TED talk that I was most excited about in Vancouver was Shah Rukh Khan's. And I was excited about it to a degree that very few of the other non-Indian TED attendees were, because I think a very large part of the audience and quite a few of the TED team themselves had no idea what an absolute phenomenon Shah Rukh Khan is.
Can you talk a little bit about who he is?
Sure. Yeah. So Shah Rukh Khan is India's biggest Bollywood star. And when I say that, that underplays his stature, because he is the ultimate hero for the entire Indian diaspora all around the world. And I first got a sense of this 2 years ago, because I was invited to speak at the annual conference for the Indian Advertising Association in Kochi in Kerala. And Shah Rukh Khan was the opening keynote speaker. And first of all, I mean, he is an incredibly impressive speaker. He's extremely intelligent, very charming, very witty, very entertaining. And so he gave a phenomenal talk, in the course of which, to my absolute delight, he talked about the importance of gender equality. So he then opened up the floor to a Q&A session, and I asked a question about gender equality, which he answered, you know, in a very, very good and very impressive way. Then, because the audience at this conference was a couple of thousand people, plus because it was Shah Rukh Khan, all the hotel staff were peering around the doors of the conference hall. And so, you know, everyone called on him to do a Bollywood song and dance number. And so he agreed to do the Lungi dance on stage, which is this very famous song and dance number that he did, I think, in a movie called Chennai Express. I may be wrong about that. And anyway, so he called people to come up on the stage and dance with him, and I was called up on stage. And so I did the Lungi dance with Shah Rukh Khan. And first of all, that was enormous fun, obviously. So a couple of things happened subsequently. I just thought he was wonderful. And so I just tweeted that night, oh my God, Shah Rukh Khan is my new hero, you know, and I got to do the Lungi dance with him. And he tweeted back at me and said, you know, you're an awesome lady, you know, it was great to dance with you, or something along those lines. And I then discovered what happens when somebody with 25 million Twitter followers tweets at you. You know, my Twitter timeline was completely swamped. And then the next morning, I went into breakfast at the hotel, and the doorman said to me, Miss, you're on the front page of the newspaper. And I went, yeah, sure, you know, don't know what you're talking about. Got to breakfast, where they had all the newspapers laid out to pick up at the door. And I discovered I was indeed on the front page of every single newspaper in India doing the Lungi dance with Shah Rukh Khan. And so I got a sense 2 years ago in India of what a phenomenon Shah Rukh Khan is and the kind of worship that his fans have for him. And so I was enormously excited about his TED Talk. And, you know, I predicted there would be a complete, like, Twitter storm around it, which there was. And his talk was wonderful. I mean, he was extremely entertaining. He came on stage and said to the audience, I understand that many of you have never seen my work, and I feel very sorry for you. and went from there. But he also, I liked his talk because, to be honest, you know, TED these days rehearses every speaker to an absolute finish and polish. And in some cases, I would say possibly over-rehearses and over-coaches, because there is now a particular, you know, format and cadence for a TED Talk, you know, and when you sit there through the week, you kind of recognize, you know, the TED opener, the TED closer, the pace, the phrasing, the peaks, the troughs. And in Shah Rukh Khan's case, you know, and I'm taking this from what I saw and also what he said in interviews, he obviously didn't have, you know, because of his schedule and the fact, you know, he's traveling around in India, he obviously had not been rehearsed and coached in that way. And so what I loved about his talk was, first of all, it was all him. Secondly, you know, it wasn't packaged and formatted. And thirdly, you know, he took the opportunity to, the theme of the TED this year was the future you. And he took the opportunity to talk about what the future we should be from an Indian cultural and societal context. And I just loved that. And so it was a talk that was uniquely him, uniquely his personality and his approach. It was extremely entertaining. And yeah, that was my that was my favorite TED Talk of the week, and the one that I would tell everyone to look out for.
Well, we look forward to seeing that TED Talk. I think it's a good cue. You are a accomplished public speaker as well, and you've had talks at the TED conference as well. So maybe we can pause here a moment, and I would love to ask you, what do you think are the what is the recipe for good public speaking? I think, you know, in the idea of people early in their careers, you know, and I've seen as a Sankar as well, the concept of or the practice of public speaking is something that becomes a theme, becomes a topic, becomes something, an issue, a concern, and people struggle with it, right? So I'd be curious to hear, what advice would you have to share for people who are developing their public speaking skills?
Sure. So I have a very simple piece of advice to share. I'm a huge fan of radical simplicity. I believe in keeping everything as simple as possible. And you will, in fact, find my advice online, written up as a very short post, because I wrote it up for my friend Heidi Hackamer, who is a wonderful woman who comes out of the ad industry, has started her own strategic agency, Wolf and Willemien. And she and her team regularly publish a magazine online and offline called Howl. And so she asked me to write a piece on precisely what you've just asked about. And so if your listeners Google Cindy Gallup, Howl, Wolf and Willemien, The 1 Minute Guide to Presenting Like a Motherfucker, then you will find it. But I will now share that advice with you and your
We'll link it in the show notes as well.
Fantastic. So the big mistake that people make when they have to give a talk, give a presentation, is to think, oh my God, I have to give a presentation. And then the presentation takes over. It becomes this thing completely disembodied from you that is utterly terrifying. So my advice to people is very simple. First of all, whatever theme you are asked to speak on, to present about, take that theme and think about how you would like to use it to say what you want to say to the audience. Okay, because you can agree to speak on anything and then make it be about what you would really want it to be. Okay, so so decide in the context of whatever the occasion is, you know, what you want to talk about. Then, when you do that, it's a safe bet that whatever you want to talk about is, you know, a fundamental part of what you do, what you believe in, what you're passionate about. And therefore, that it's something you talk about regularly, you know, to friends over the dinner table in a bar. So basically, what I recommend to people is take whatever you would normally say on this topic to friends over the dinner table and back it into your presentation. Okay? Because when you go out on stage and you know that you are simply going to say what you say to your friends across the dinner table all the time, first of all, that makes you very confident because you know exactly what you're talking about. Secondly, it means that all you're going to do is you're going to replicate that conversation. And so you are going to be relaxed and conversational about how you do it. And thirdly, what that means is that it will be entertaining and interesting for the audience because it is entertaining and interesting for your friends when you talk about it in a very personal context to them in an informal environment. Just do that.
It's great advice. We jump straight in. I want to go back a little bit. Can you describe how and where you grew up?
So I'm really not particularly interested in doing that. I have a sunglasses case that says, don't look back, you're not going that way. But since you ask, very briefly, I'm half English, half Chinese, and I grew up in Brunei in Borneo.
How was that growing up there?
Growing up in Brunei was a lot more boring than it sounds. It's a very small, very orthodox Muslim country on the coast of Borneo. It was tedious as hell.
Okay. What were some of the early influences that shaped in your early life that shaped who you are today?
I haven't the faintest idea.
Okay.
I'm completely serious, David. My life and my career is a series of accidents. You know, obviously, I would say, as anybody would, that my parents undoubtedly, you know, obviously they shape my upbringing and my future in some form or other. But I am really, really uninterested in analysing my past. You know, the past happened. It absolutely made me the person I am today. I have no particular understanding how. I'm not particularly interested in finding out.
When you talk about a series of accidents, what was the accident that got you into advertising?
I basically began my career in theatre. I went to Oxford University. I studied English language and literature there. And I really, really fell madly in love with theatre at Oxford because Oxford has a very thriving student drama scene. And so I had the opportunity there to do everything related to theatre. I was the president of my college, Somerville, the Somerville Drama Society. I wrote, acted, directed, stage managed, worked on every aspect of a production and decided basically that all I wanted to do was work in theatre the rest of my life. I knew I wasn't good enough to be an actress or director. But one of the things I used to do a lot when I was younger was draw. And from drawing, I got pulled by my friends into designing theatre posters for their productions. And from there, I kind of got sucked into, you know, oh, Cindy, now you've done the poster, can you go out and sell the show for us? And I really enjoyed doing that. So I became a theatre publicity and marketing officer at a number of theatres in the UK. And I did that for several years until I got completely fed up with basically working 24/7 and earning chicken feed, which is what happens in theatre. And at the time, I was the marketing officer for the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool. And part of my job at promoting the theatre was giving talks to groups. So I gave a talk to a group of women, And after it, one of them came up to me and she said, young lady, you could sell a fridge to an Eskimo. And I thought, okay, that is the universe telling me something. Time to set out to the establishment, go into advertising. So I did.
And can you talk a little bit about how these first few years in advertising were for you as a, when was that?
That would have been 1985.
Yeah, 1985. How was the advertising world then, as compared to today, for someone like you who entered that industry?
Well, in many ways it was very different, and in other ways it was exactly the same. So, in terms of difference, back in the 80s, advertising, and we're talking advertising in the UK here in London, was an incredibly sexy industry in the sense that everybody wanted to work in advertising. A lot of people in the industry would say that, that was part of advertising's heyday. I disagree with that for reasons I'm sure we'll come on to discuss. But I had an absolute whale of a time for a couple of reasons. One is that when I say I went into advertising, it wasn't that easy, precisely because it was a very attractive industry. It was very competitive and very hard to get in. And first of all, I tried applying to a bunch of agencies and came up against that conundrum of we can't hire you because you have no experience, but you can't get any experience because we're not going to hire you. So I then regressed several years and rejoined the university, what we used to call the Milk Round, which was the graduate recruitment program, because a lot of the big agencies in London at the time operated entry-level graduate trainee programs where they recruited you fresh out of university and put you through a very comprehensive training program for, anything between several months to up to a year before you actually, then were fully fledged account executive planner, whatever it was. So I joined an agency called Ted Bates in London back in 1985. Ted Bates no longer exists. And it was fantastic for a couple of reasons. The first is that there's something enormously liberating about going right back to the beginning. And incidentally, I took a drop in salary from what I'd been earning as a marketing officer in theatre. But that was fine because I knew I would, make it up and overtake it pretty rapidly, which I did. But what that meant was that I was at the very bottom of the ladder. There was a real liberation to being the most junior person in the room, running around making coffee, being trained and educated, but actually having the opportunity to regress. And it was a huge amount of fun. And then secondly, Ted Bates was a lovely agency. It wasn't the most creative agency in London, but the people were wonderful. I made friends there. I still have. And I just absolutely loved it. I had a whale of a time.
When you talk about regressing and going a level down, in hindsight, what do you think is the, like, what was your decision-making process of doing this? Because it sounds a little bit counterintuitive to do that, right? And what was going on in your mind? Like, how did you make that decision? Did you follow a particular process in deciding to say, okay, this is what I want to do, and here's the pros and cons? Or like, can you talk a bit about that decision? Because it is a decision to go back a little bit, right?
You could look at it that way, but as I mentioned earlier, my life and my career have been a series of accidents. I have never thought through anything, planned, deliberated. That was simply a function of I'm not going to get into advertising any other way. I've tried the route of kind of going, I'm already doing this in theatre marketing. I have all these skills. You should hire me, as an account manager, whatever. People aren't doing that. That's not working. So I'm going to have to do something different. And the only other way I can see to get into advertising is to go right back to the beginning and apply as an entry-level graduate trainee. And if I do that, I have a better chance of getting in. And I know that, the reason I'm looking at advertising is because I want to earn a lot more money and progress a lot further than theatre will ever allow me to do. And so that simply requires, two steps back, three steps forward. So there really wasn't a great deal more thought to it than there is no other route in. Yeah. And so I'm going to pursue this one.
Yeah, it sounds like an investment step into the long game, right? So talk a bit of long game. You've spent many years in advertising, and your career spans over a long time in advertising, I think 15 to 20 years. Can you talk a bit about, briefly, about your evolution in the industry, and what are the key phases that you've gone through and some of the learnings from that time?
I put my head down and I worked really hard. And, you know, I'm saying that, David, because, again, you know, my career progression does not package itself up neatly as a series of self-help lessons. It didn't work like that. Okay, everything that I now know and advise people came out of the sheer process of living for 57 years and having a career that was a series of accidents that, you know, sent me to places I'd never planned. And since I left the corporate world, has given me a much more clear-sighted perspective, which means that, you know, I now am able to talk much more cogently about things I do think people should take into account. But if you ask me to represent my career as a series of packaged self-help steps, I can't do that because it didn't work like that, it didn't play out like that, and I didn't experience it like that.
Okay. You left the UK to come to the US to build the US office of VBH, which is a large advertising agency from the UK. What was that? What compelled you? What inspired that step?
So, that again was initially accidental. Years previously, when I was a young, thrusting, ambitious account director at BBH in London, I pinned Nigel Bogle, my boss, up against the wall, and I went, "Where am I going in this agency?" As you do, as a young, ambitious account director. And Nigel did the management trick of turning the question back on me. And so he said, "You tell us what you want to do, Cindy, and we'll make it happen." And he went, don't be bounded by the realms of the possible. If you want a job that does not yet exist in this agency, ask for it. So I went, "Oh, gosh, okay, fair enough." Went away, thought about it. Came back to Nigel and said, "Okay, my dream job is one day running BBH North America. And to be my total dream job, I'd be doing that in New York." And at the time, we had one office in London, and Nigel said, "Well, you know, that's interesting, Cindy, because we have recently started talking about, you know, one day, you know, looking at expanding into the US, and so your request is logged." So, a couple of years later, our first office outside London was actually Asia Pacific, because that was where the client demand for us to have a presence was, and so I went out to Singapore to help start and run BBH Asia Pacific as the number two to the CEO, Simon Sherwood. Did that for 2 years, and then I finally had the opportunity to come over to New York and start up BBH New York. And so that was how that happened.
When you say you pinned up your boss against the wall, like, what is the learning here? Like the way you describe that is that it felt for you like the impulse to do that, right? Like, "I want this, I'm asking for it." For people who hesitate to do that, what do you tell them?
What I tell them is what I tell everybody, which is the only person who can make things happen for you is you. And the point there is that you do not need, as I did not, obviously, to have the path forward all mapped out and to ask for it. All you need is to go, you know, either I'm not happy with where I am now, or I want to do something more in this area, and then proactively take the first step towards making that happen and opening up the opportunity. Because, you know, when you do that, you will find out very quickly whether the opportunity is there or not. And if it's not, you want to get the fuck out.
What is the importance, or is there an importance, or do you put an importance on it, of an internal network or internal set of mentors or role models to sustain that, like to amplify that that ambition?
Right. So I'm really glad you brought that up, because I'm now going to answer that question with what I want to say about role models, which is not a direct answer to your question, but has some bearing on it. So, you've told me that this podcast is all about role models. And what I think is enormously important in the interests of gender equality is that female role models are just as critical for men as they are for women. When I say you cannot be what you cannot see, that absolutely applies to women in tech, in advertising, in any industry, where, you know, it is not a pipeline problem. I get sick to death of hearing people say about tech, oh, we have to get more women into STEM. Oh, we have to encourage more women to, you know, study computer science at university. It doesn't matter how many women you bring in at the bottom if you show them nowhere to go at the top. And by the way, a lot of that emphasis is because it's a lot easier for the closed loop at the top of the industry of white guys talking to white guys about other white guys to go, oh, yeah, yeah, we want to help solve that gender equality diversity issue by bringing in lots of women at the bottom, because that's a lot less threatening. It is way more threatening to go, we need to bring women to stand side by side with us on an equal level in power at the top. But that's what you need to do if you genuinely want a gender equal future. And if you don't, by the way, you're an idiot, because the future is female. There is a huge amount of money to be made out of taking women seriously that every industry is missing out on. But equally important, you cannot be what you cannot see applies also to men. Every single industry will be far better off when men learn from female role models. And part of the problem right now is that many senior men in every industry believe that men have nothing to learn from women and that men do not see women as role models, and they could not be more wrong. So, you know, I talk about, in my business speaking, I talk about the fact that some years ago, I gave a talk at the School of Communication Arts in London, which is one of the UK's best advertising schools. And I gave a talk about the future of advertising to a group of, you know, young men and women all studying advertising who want to get jobs in the ad industry. And sometime later, I came across a blog post online, which was written by one of the young men who attended that talk. The blog post was titled, "The Day I Met Cindy Gallup." And it opened by saying, you know, in fact, it was a very entertaining opening. It opened by saying something along these lines. Every theme park has its star attraction. Jurassic Park has its Tyrannosaurus Rex. You know, Disney World has its Space Mountain. Even within our little, you know, advertising school, there are surprises to be had. And he made the point that, you know, this school sees the great and good of advertising come through it all the time, you know, talking. He said, you know, just the day before we'd had Sir John Hegarty, who's my old boss, by the way, huge creative figure. What could possibly top that? And then he went on to talk about me and what I spoke to him about and how blown away he was by my talk about the insights, you know, how many of the great and good in advertising stood in front of them and said, this is how it's going to be, dot PowerPoint, and had no answers, whereas Cindy did. And I quote that blog post because that was a young white guy in advertising going, wow, this woman is a total role model. He finished his post with, the world needs more heroes like Cindy Gallup. I have a very large young male fan base for everything I do, business, advertising, you know, startups, make love, not porn. And I can say categorically that especially the current generation of millennial men totally welcome women as role models in a way that, you know, their old white male counterparts don't even conceive of as possible, because who could possibly have anything to learn from a woman? That's very mistaken thinking. So I would urge you very strongly to merchandise your role model events and this podcast to men as much as women. Because when men learn from the female way of doing things, they learn the traits and the dynamics and the lessons that they need to succeed in the future. And they also learn to welcome in women as professional counterparts on the same level as them. So female role models are critically important to both women and men. There are far too few of them, because it's much, much easier and much less threatening to go, oh, it's all about the bottom end of our industry, it's a pipeline issue, versus the way more difficult task of welcoming in women as leadership equals, putting them in positions equal to or even above you. And, you know, separate to role models, to pull apart the two strands of your question. What I always say to women is strike the word mentor from your vocabulary immediately. Get rid of it. Because too many people go, oh, women need mentors. And the word mentor has a sense of touchy-feely, talking it out, you know, burble, burble, burble. Women don't need mentors. Women need champions. Women need people prepared to do what men get all the time, which is go out on a limb for them. Women need the person who, behind closed boardroom doors, will slam their fist on the table and go, if there's only room in the budget for one pay rise in my department, it's going to Jane, not John. Champions make shit happen for you. And so it's critically important that women find those champions. And quite often, regrettably, those champions will be men, because they have to be, because those are the people who dominate the upper echelons of any industry. But women need to understand, they need to find those people in their company, in their industry, who will help make shit happen for them. And I've been very lucky, again, inadvertently, because I was not thinking this consciously, climbing the career ladder, but I have worked for men who were phenomenal champions for me, who saw my potential and wanted me to realize it. And that is very important as well, because, you know, in every industry, what is keeping the playing field unequal is that men get hired, promoted, and funded on potential, and women get hired, promoted, and funded on proof. When you have male-dominated leadership in every company, in every industry, it's really easy for a male leader to look at a man coming up through the ranks and go, oh, he reminds me of myself at his age. I can see myself in him. He's great to have a beer with. I reckon he can do the job. I reckon his company will fly. Let's give him that huge amount of money. Women are subject to a completely different set of standards. Well, has she done the job before? Has she done the job long enough? Has she done the job well enough? Well, this startup of yours, you know, can you show me every possible proof point that doesn't currently exist because it's such an innovative idea, but you have to show me? Women are hired, promoted, and funded on proof, and frequently not even then. Women can prove every fucking proof point going, and they still won't get the job, they won't get the promotion, and they won't get the funding. So there's a very easy way to change all of this. Hire, fund, and promote men on potential and on proof, and hire, fund, and promote women on potential. And trust me, when you do that, you'll see a very different picture. And so find the champions who see your potential and want to help make shit happen for you because of that.
What makes a good champion? How do I find a champion? How do I identify a champion?
Again, I like to keep things very simple. First of all, a champion is somebody who has the power to make shit happen for you. You want to find a champion who is in a position where they can get you that job, get you that promotion, get you that funding. And then they have to want to help you. And that is basically a function of how much you prove to them you deserve to be helped. And that's entirely up to you.
What is something that companies can do? I mean, you alluded to it already a little bit, but practically, what can companies do? What would the three tips you would give companies that they could implement very easily if they're open to it, to resolve this difference between men getting hired for potential and women for proof?
Okay, so tip number one is very simple. Hire me as a consultant. And I make that point very seriously. And by the way, I make that point not out of self-interest, although obviously I would very much like this to be the case. But the reason I say that is because I have, again, inadvertently, over the past 10, 11 years, found myself a champion and an advocate for gender equality and diversity. And by the way, when I say diversity, I mean diversity of everything. Not just gender, but diversity of race, ethnicity, sexuality, disability, age. The reason that's important is because diversity drives innovation. Innovation disruption is the result of many different mindsets, perspectives, insights, worldviews, backgrounds, experiences coming together in constructive creative conflict to get to a far better place none of us could have gotten to on our own. So I've been championing gender equality and diversity for 11 years for a very simple reason, because that is how you innovate and that is how you make an absolute goddamn fucking shit ton of money. I'm a hard-headed businesswoman, and diversity is key to everything. However, none of this is showing up in my bank account. And I say that because that's a problem for the entire business world and every single industry as a whole, because nobody is putting their money where their mouth is. The fundamental reason that gender equality and diversity is not happening is because, as I said earlier, at the top of every industry is a closed loop of white guys talking to white guys about other white guys. Those white guys are sitting very pretty. They have their enormous salaries, their gigantic bonuses, their huge pools of stock options, their lavish expense accounts. Why on earth would they ever want to rock the boat? Oh, they have to talk diversity. They have to appoint a head of diversity. They have to put diversity initiatives in place. They have to say the word diversity a lot. But deep down, fundamentally, they don't want to change a thing because the system is working just fine for them as it currently is. It's like the old joke about the light bulb. How many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to really want to change. And those white guys at the top don't really want to change. So if you are a company that thinks you really do want to change, what you do is you hire me as a consultant, because I can get you to change in a way that you will not be able to get to yourself. And the reason I say that is because, again, my background is 30 years working in brand building, marketing, and advertising. I am all about communication through demonstration. My own industry does not take the approach diversity it should, which is how we do anything we do for our clients. Enormously clever and ingenious strategy, and enormously creative and impactful and effective execution. Because when you do that superficial thing of appointing a head of diversity, putting diversity initiatives in place, talking diversity, that is not effective for two reasons. The first is that all of that makes the white men in your company enormously resentful. When a and by the way, everything I'm saying is entirely backed up by data and research. When a company says it's all about diversity, the people who are the status quo feel very unhappy about that. As the saying goes, when you are used to privilege, equality feels like oppression. So that doesn't help anything change internally. And secondly, many research studies over the years have proven that when we do something that is supposedly virtuous in one area, we'll feel able to carry on with whatever we're doing that isn't virtuous in others. The classic example being that, you know, at a very basic level, if you buy a Diet Coke instead of a full-fat Coke, then it's okay to have the chips. So when you know that your company is all about diversity, that it's promoting diversity, that part of its corporate mission is diversity, that it has a head of diversity, that it has a diversity program, you can carry on interviewing and hiring the same white guys you always do, because that's all taken care of somewhere else. Doesn't work.
If you look 10 years ahead, what has changed?
So you've asked that question in completely the wrong way. Okay, I get asked this question in different contexts all the time. So, Cindy, when do you think all of this will change? I get asked it about diversity. I get asked it about how repressed we are about sex in the context of my startup, Make Love Not Porn. And the problem with the way that you've asked that question is that you've asked it in the passive tense. All of this changes when you and I and everybody else make it change. And I don't wait for things to change. I make them change. There is no future that happens without us. There is no future that happens of its own volition and rolls us all over in its wake. My favourite quote of all time is Alan Kay, who said, in order to predict the future, you have to invent it. I'm all about decide what you want the future to be and make it happen. And so I am making the future I want to happen happen, and I'm encouraging everybody else to do the same thing. I live my own philosophies, and one of my philosophies is micro-actions, which is the core unit of my startup, If We Ran the World. Micro-actions are important because change happens from the bottom up, not the top down. Every single one of us, every single day, undertaking micro-actions, tiny bite-sized chunks of action, easy to do, to make what we want to see change, cumulatively adds up at scale to enormous, far-reaching impact.
Yeah, the compounding effects, right? Like small changes lead to a big impact. You mentioned two startups that you're the CEO and co-founder of.
Before we do that, I want to go back to your point about role models. And I want to talk about this in the context of Germany, given that, you know, obviously we are a German podcast here. So I've spoken in Germany on a number of occasions for a number of conferences over the past 10 years. And I spoke at a conference in Berlin, and possibly to spare their blushes, I will not cite which conference this was. It was a long time ago. It was 7 years ago. But, you know, I was asked to come and speak about technology, social media, whatever specific themes were relevant to the conference at the time. And it was one of those conferences where they didn't button down the agenda until very close to the actual conference date. And so I only saw this literally a couple of days before I was due to get on the plane and fly to Germany. But they sent me the conference schedule. This is a conference with three concurrent tracks. And I saw that I and almost all the other female speakers had been slotted into a specific track that was called Social Women. And I looked at this and I was not happy. And so I wrote to the conference organizer that I've been liaising with, who was a woman, and I said to her, oh, you know, I see him in a track called Social Women. So where is the Social Men track? And she went, oh, no, Cindy, we don't have one because we just think, well, you women are so amazing, we've put you all on a track by yourself. Now, I was deeply unthrilled about this, but 2 days before the conference, there was not a lot I could do about it. So a couple of things about that. What happened when that track began was exactly what I knew and predicted would happen. 2/3 of the audience got up and left, i.e. all the men in the audience. Because we as women are expected all the time to be riveted by all male panels, be fascinated by and pay to attend conferences with all male speaker lineups, whereas men, when they see a panel that is all women, won't attend and have no interest in attending women's conferences. So 2/3 of the audience left. And in the Q&A after the first session, which was a panel that I was on, the women in the audience were furious, and the questions were nothing to do with what we've been talking about. They demanded to know of the male MC why on earth the conference had scheduled all the women into one track in a kind of pink ghetto. At the same conference, I was really taken aback to discover that 90% of the attendees were men, only 10% were women. I had this conference with the organisers who said to me that reflected the tech industry in Germany. And so that was my introduction to how very male-dominated the tech world is in Germany. So that directly impacted my most recent German speaking experience. So I spoke, I did a fireside chat, and I sat in a panel at Zalando's excellent, by the way, Visions conference in Berlin just a few weeks ago. And when they booked me, they then subsequently told me that the fireside chat, which would be where I'd be interviewed by the wonderful Natalia Brzezinski, who is based in Stockholm, and has a terrific event, Symposium for Brilliant Minds. And she was meant to interview me on the theme of the challenges that women face in management. It was the title was something like "To Be or Not to Be." The tragedy of women in management. So when I spoke to her and Katie, the organizer, I said, "That title is a really bad idea because it guarantees that the men will all leave the hall." I actually want to get my message of gender quantum diversity over. But in order to do that, I want to approach it completely differently. I want to make damn sure that I'm talking to every single man at that conference. So I'm talking to a jam-packed conference hall. And so, first of all, I want to retitle that chat. And I want to call it... And I gave them the title... your inside track on the future, how to beat the competition, own your industry, and make a shit ton of money. I wanted a title that would have every man in the audience going, ooh, you know, should check that out. Then I said to Natalia, I want to creatively ambush the men, and so I want you to ask me a general question about business to begin with, because she had a whole set of questions about gender quantity and diversity. I said, ask me a general question about business, because what I want to do is I want to deliver some very impressive general business insights that will make the men in the audience respect me as a speaker and want to hear what I have to say. And then I want to hit them with everything I want to hit them with. So that was what we did. And in fact, Katie liked this so much, she moved it up to be the opening session of the conference. And it went down an absolute storm with the men as well as the women, all of whom found the things I had to say helpful, insightful, and practicable and actionable. So that is the approach to take if you want to get the men of the tech industry, the men of the German tech industry, on board. It's communication through demonstration, because obviously what that also was really interesting business insights from a woman, which opens up the mind to maybe we do have things to learn from women. And so, you know, I refuse to speak on panels about diversity. I refuse to talk about them. By the way, I totally will do that when you pay me, because I support myself through paid public speaking. But wherever I have a choice for a broad public audience versus, I mean, companies are booking me to come in and talk to them about specifically about diversity, equality, and so on. But... retitle it, reframe it, make it clear this is a business issue, not a gender quantum diversity issue.
Yeah, I make the personal commitment not to accept any invitations on a panel or on a conference that has, it's an all-male panel, for example.
Good.
Played back to them. And I found the reaction very interesting of a conference organizer almost being offended by me giving them feedback about this and rejecting it for that particular reason. Very interesting reaction.
People get very defensive.
Yeah. You left the advertising industry a while ago to pursue your own company as a consultant, public speaker, etc. And the co-founder and CEO of two startups. What compelled that change or exiting the advertising industry as an active player and do your own thing?
Again, I left the advertising industry kind of by accident. Back in 2005, I turned 45 and I had my very own personal midlife crisis, in the sense that I'd always thought of 45 as kind of a midlife point. Obviously, by the way, in the happy assumption one lives to be 90, fingers crossed. But in the couple of years running up to it, I always thought on one's 45th birthday is the moment when you should pause, take stock, reflect and review, where have I been, where am I going? And so on February 1, 2005, my 45th birthday, I duly did that. And that was the point at which I went, oh my God, I've just worked 16 years for the same advertising agency. Wonderful agency, by the way. I mean, love BBH to death, cannot say enough nice things about them. I'd worked for them in London, in Singapore, in New York. And the time had flown by, but, you know, I went, wow, you know, maybe it's time to do something different. And then the problem was I hadn't the faintest idea what. So vast amounts of thought and angsting ensued, and eventually I went, if I want to examine every possible option open to me for what is effectively the second half of my life, maybe the best thing to do is to put myself on the market very publicly and go, okay, guys, here I am, what have you got, and see what comes. So, yeah.
What did you do there? Like, how did you put yourself out there in the market?
Well, basically, I left BBH, resigned as chairman of BBH New York in the summer of 2005 without a job to go to. And it was, as I knew it would be, huge news because I was a BBH lifer, I'd been there for so long. And, flatteringly, many other agencies had, tried to tempt me away, offered me jobs. I remember there was a wonderful man called Ken Case, who was the CEO of DDB, who very sadly passed away from cancer some years ago, who was a very good friend of mine. In fact, he was one of the people who gave me the confidence to do this. But years and years ago, when Ken and I first met, he then asked me out to lunch. And we had a great lunch where I was telling him how much I was loving, building BBH New York. He told me sometime later that he'd actually asked me out to lunch to offer me the job of president of DDB New York. And before he could even get anything in, I just launched into how much I was loving building BBH. And he said to me, I felt like, a man on a first date who's just discovered the woman's lesbian. so it was very big news at the time. Instantly, I was very flatteringly swamped with offers, basically. And equally at the time, I went, okay, I still don't know what I want to do. I'm going to be an employment slut. I'm going to talk to everybody. I'm going to take every phone call, do every meeting, embarked on a fascinating exploratory, which was as good for telling me what I didn't want to do as what I did want to do. Because I would do a meeting or an interview, and I'd come out and I'd go, okay, now I know in 50 million years, no one do that. but I have to say, that was the best thing, making that jump was the best thing I ever did in my life. Because I am now evangelical about working for yourself. And it's what I advise everyone to do, especially women and people of colour. Because, this is where I differ from Sheryl Sandberg, whom I'm otherwise a huge fan of. Sheryl wants us to lean in within the existing system. And I want us to redesign the system. Why on earth would women and people of colour want to labour away within an organisation that is built on white male corporate values? By the way, we would absolutely want to work in an organisation that embraces the need to rethink and reinvent those values based on welcoming in the talents and the skills and creativity of women and people of colour. Those organisations are very few and far between. I get very frustrated when people, talk about the fact that there aren't women at the top because, women are on the mommy track, having kids and families, or, women don't have the same sense of ambition that men do, or, women are too sensible to... there is a degree, by the way, to which women are too sensible in the sense that, women look at the top of any company, any industry, and that closed loop of white guys talking to white guys about other white guys and go, who the fuck would ever want to work like that? But that does not mean we don't want to be at the top. We absolutely want to be at the top. Never doubt that women burn with the same ferocious ambition, desire for power, desire to make an absolute goddamn fucking shit ton of money that men do. But the odds are stacked against us. Why would we, labour away for years when we're never going to bloody make it up there? And by the way, a huge reason that we never make it up there is sexual harassment, which I speak about all the time in my business speaking because nobody else does. Sexual harassment manages women out of companies, out of industries, derails dreams, destroys ambitions, ruins careers. And so, what I say to women is... when you are sexually harassed, you've got to call it out. You think your career is fucked if you do, your career is fucked if you don't. And to men, I say, stop sexual harassment. Stop doing it and stop other men doing it. And by the way, it's very easy to stop sexual harassment immediately without even addressing it directly. The moment you get to gender equal working environments, gender equal management teams, gender equal leadership, you don't even have to worry about sexual harassment anymore because sexual harassment does not happen in professional environments that are gender equal, where there is not the male-dominated implicit bro endorsement of it's okay to work like that, and there is not the male-dominated environment where, because men do not engage with women every day as professional equals in quantity, men see women in one of only two roles, secretary or girlfriend.
The startups you mentioned earlier, if I ran the world and make love and not porn, what is the impetus of those startups, and how did you get from deciding to leave the industry to starting those two companies?
Sure. So if we ran the world, if we ran the world is the culmination of my over 30 years working in advertising, which has led me to believe that the future of business is doing good and making money simultaneously. And not in the old world order way that most companies currently do that, which goes, we make money here, then we do good by writing checks to causes to clear our conscience over here. But the new world order way of we make money because we do good. We find a way to integrate social responsibility into the way we do business on a day-to-day basis that therefore makes it a key driver of future growth and profitability. So I believe the business model of the future is shared values plus shared action equals shared profit, financial profit and social profit. In other words, when brands and businesses come together with their consumers, their audiences, on the basis... Oh my God, that's Alexa, sorry. I'll start that again. When brands and businesses come together with their consumers, their audiences, on the basis of values that you all share, which, by the way, is the most important requirement for a good relationship in life as much as business. You will never truly bond if you don't share the same values. And if you are then enabled to collaboratively and collectively co-act on those values, to walk the talk together, you can make things happen in the real world that will benefit consumers, benefit society, and benefit the brand and its business. So if we ran the world is co-action software that enables brands to implement that business model. So I was working on If Around the World when Make Love Not Porn blew up, and that was a complete accident, and I had to back burner If We Around the World in order to take Make Love Not Porn forwards, although the only good thing about having to do that, which was frustrating, is because even I, superhuman as I am, cannot run two startups simultaneously. But actually, the sheer passage of time has meant that If We Around the World is more relevant now than ever before. People reach out about it regularly. And if I can get Make Love Not Porn funded, hire a full-time team to run it, then I want to go back and reactivate If We Around the World, which, by the way, is a Harvard Business School case study. So we were 12 months old in public beta, and Harvard Business School reached out to me and said, this is such an infant model, we want to write it up as a case study and we want to teach it. So I had this very surreal experience of, you know, sitting in the back of a lecture theatre at Harvard Business School, hearing my little 12-month-old startup being taught as a case study. And students, you know, reach out to me from business schools all around the world, you know, still going, oh my God, this is amazing, you know, I want to help. Anyway, so while I was working on that, where Make Love Not Porn came from is that I date younger men who tend to be men in their 20s. And about 10 or 11 years ago, and so bear in mind, this is before the media ever picked up on any of this, I began realizing through dating younger men that I was encountering what happens when two things converge. And I stress the dual convergence because most people think it's only one. I realized I was experiencing what happens when today's total freedom of access to hardcore porn online meets our society's equally total reluctance to talk openly and honestly about sex. The convergence of both of those factors results in porn becoming, by default, the sex education today in not a good way. So, being a naturally action-oriented person, I decided something about this. I put up on no money, 9 years ago, a clunky little website at makelovenotporn.com that posts the myths of hardcore porn, balances them with reality. The construct was porn world versus real world. I launched at TED in 2009. I became the only TED speaker to have said the words come on my face on the TED stage 6 times. Talk went viral as a result, and it drove an extraordinary global response to my tiny clunky website that I had never anticipated. I realized I'd uncovered a huge global social issue. And so I saw an opportunity to do exactly what I believe in, do good and make money simultaneously. I saw the opportunity for a big business solution to this huge untapped global social need. And I use the word big advisedly because even back in 2009 at concept stage, I knew that if I wanted to counter the global impact of porn as default sex ed, I was going to have to come up with something that at least had the potential one day to be just as mass, just as mainstream, and as all-pervasive in our society as porn currently is. So what I decided to do was, I always emphasize to people that Make Love Not Porn is not anti-porn because the issue isn't porn. The issue is that we don't talk about sex in the real world. If we did, amongst a whole host of other benefits, people would then bring a real-world mindset when they view what is simply artificial entertainment. Our tagline at Make Love Not Porn is pro-sex, pro-porn, pro-knowing the difference. And our mission is one thing only, which is to help make it easier for the world to talk about sex. Talk about sex openly and honestly in the public domain. By that I mean parents to kids, teachers to classrooms, everyone to everyone. And talk about sex openly and honestly privately in your intimate relationships. So I decided to take every dynamic that exists in social media and apply them to this one area no other social network or platform will go in order to socialize sex and to make real world sex and talking about it socially acceptable and therefore ultimately just as socially shareable as anything else we share on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. So 4 years ago, my team and I launched the first stage of this vision, MakeLoveNotPorn.tv, which is an entirely user-generated crowdsourced video sharing platform that celebrates real-world sex. So anyone from anywhere in the world can submit to us videos of themselves having real-world sex, and we're very clear what we mean by this. We are not porn. We're not amateur. We're building a whole new category on the internet that has never previously existed, social sex. So our competition isn't porn. It's Facebook and YouTube, or rather it would be if Facebook and YouTube allowed sexual self-expression and self-identification, which they don't. So social sex videos on Make Love Not Porn are not about performing for the camera. They're just about doing what you do on every other social platform, capturing what goes on in the real world as it happens spontaneously in all its messy, funny, silly, ridiculous, glorious, wonderful humanness. We curate to make sure of that, watch every single video, don't publish unless it's real, and we have a revenue-sharing business model. We're part of the sharing economy, like Uber and Airbnb. You pay to rent and stream social sex videos, and then half the income goes to our contributors, or as we call them, our Make Love Not Porn stars. Because we would like our Make Love Not Porn stars one day to be as famous as YouTube stars, for the same reasons, authenticity, realness, individuality, and to make just as much money. We want to hit the kind of critical mass where one day your social sex video hits 1 million rentals at $5 per rental. We give you half the income. We are the answer to the economy.
Now, that's a fascinating thing to work on. And I was curious, what are some of the challenges that you tackle in this area, right? Like, so we see, we've seen the emergence of vertical verticalization of things like you know, in the technology world, like fintech and food tech, and I think you're one of the contributors in the area of sex tech. So, what are some of the challenges that you face with growing and developing Make Love Not Porn, and how do you tackle them?
The one thing I did not realize when I embarked on this venture was that my team and I would fight an enormous battle every single day to build it. Essentially because every piece of business infrastructure any other tech startup can just take for granted, we can't, because the small print always says no adult content. And this is all pervasive across every single area of the business in ways that people outside this sphere do not realize. I can't get funded. I can't get banked. It took me 4 years to find a bank that would allow me to open a business bank account for Make Love Not Porn. Our biggest operational challenge is payments. PayPal won't work with adult content. Stripe can't. Mainstream credit card processors won't. Every single tech service that I want to use, be it hosting, encoding, encrypting, the TOS always say no adult content. I have to go to the people at the top of the company, explain what we're doing, beg to be allowed to use their platform. We had to build our entire video streaming, video sharing platform from scratch ourselves as proprietary technology because existing streaming services, off-the-shelf components, will not stream adult content. I'm so jealous of friends who built video startups on Vimeo. I can't do that. would have been way easier, way cheaper. Even something as apparently simple as finding an email partner. MailChimp will not work with adult content. We went through 6 or 7 who rejected us before we found SendGrid who would. So, and I should say, by the way, to contextualize, despite those obstacles, at 4 years old, Make Love Not Porn has over 400,000 members, over 200 Make Love Not Porn stars. We've had over 1,500 videos submitted. We began taking in revenue on day one. Our revenue is very low because of all our payment processing challenges. But in the past 4 years, we've generated revenue of over $500,000. The point being, in a world where the received wisdom is nobody pays for porn, our members are paying for social sex. And we've done all of that on only 2 full-time employees, one of whom is me, unpaid. Scalable or what? So I began trying to raise just $2 million in funding 2.5 years ago to scale Make Love Not Porn. That, by the way, is minimum viable investment. I'd love to raise more, but because it's so challenging, I kept it minimal. Our biggest obstacle raising funding, by the way, is the social dynamic that I call fear of what other people will think. It is never about what the person I'm talking to thinks. When you understand what we're doing and why we're doing it, no one can argue with it. The business case is clear. It's always their fear of what they think other people will think, which operates around sex unlike any other area. And by the way, fear of what other people will think is the most paralyzing dynamic in business and in life. You will never own the future if you care what other people think. So I realized, as funding was so difficult, that I was going to have to pave my own way. I have to break down the business barriers in my own path to scale Make Love Not Porn to be the billion-dollar venture I know it can be. And so I began doing what I tell other entrepreneurs to do, which is when you have a truly world-changing startup, you have to change the world to fit it, not the other way around. I am in the Steve Jobs business of reality distortion. If reality tells me that I can't grow Make Love Not Porn the way I want to, I'm going to change reality. What I mean by that is I deliberately... 2.5 years ago, began defining, pioneering and championing my own category, sex tech. And I did that purely to create a climate of receptivity to get my startup funded. So I wrote the definition of sex tech. If you Google what is sex tech, I'm result number one on page number one. And sex tech is any form of technology or tech venture designed to innovate, disrupt and enhance in any area of human sexuality and human sexual experience. I coined the hashtag sex tech. I didn't invent the term, but I'm responsible for propagating the hashtag as widely as it is used today. And I began speaking at tech conferences all around the world on why the next big thing in tech is disrupting sex. Because at base level, if I just say that loudly enough, often enough, in enough places, people start to believe it. So I've been doing this for the past 2.5 years, and I have spectacularly failed to get my own startup funded. And by the way, I've met investors who are interested, but they're all waiting for that one big lead investor. They want that one person who will make the big vote of confidence, put in a big chunk of change, then they'll all scurry in like lemmings behind. And I haven't found that one lead investor. So about 8-9 months ago, I went, okay, this isn't working. I'm going to have to take things to the next level. In order to get my own startup funded, I'm going to have to get the entire category funded. So I'm now doing 2 things simultaneously. I'm still working to raise $2 million to Make Love Not Porn because my own startup is my priority always. But at the same time, I'm now working to raise $200 million to start the world's first and only sex tech fund. Because if nobody else is going to, then I will. And by the way, I haven't the faintest idea how you start a fund, but I'm going to anyway. Someone played me back to myself on Twitter a while back. I spoke on a panel 2 years ago where I said, anything good in business only ever happened to somebody who went, don't think I'm qualified to do this, going to go ahead and do it anyway. So that's what I'm doing. So then I began doing, again, what I tell entrepreneurs to do, making it real. So I gave my fund a name. I bought the URL. I registered the company. The name of my fund is derived from a quote by Chairman Mao, who famously said many years ago, in the interests of gender equality, women hold up half the sky. I think that's relatively unambitious. My sex tech fund is called All the Sky Holdings. And the derivation is deliberate because I plan, when I can raise this fund, to invest in 2 specific areas. The first is radically innovative sex tech ventures founded by women. The most interesting things in sex tech today are coming from female founders. As I like to say, women challenge the status quo because we are never it. We are owning our sexuality, finding unique ways to leverage it, in business terms, because we get the enormous market that is women's needs, wants, and desires, historically deemed too embarrassing, shameful, or taboo to address in business terms. And by the way, when you tap into that huge primary market, you tap a huge secondary market of extremely happy men. The second area I plan to invest in is every business obstacle I encounter is a huge disruptive business opportunity in itself. I plan to fund the infrastructure of sex tech, the sex tech full stack. Because the first payment processor that operates a new definition of adult content to embrace legal, ethical, transparent sex tech ventures like mine cleans up. The first bank, the first hosting provider, the first streaming, encoding, encrypting. I want to invest in the ecosystem of sex tech in order to blow this out into the next trillion-dollar category in sex. And by the way, next trillion-dollar category in tech. And by the way, the infrastructure of sex tech is particularly where the unicorns are to be found.
We're going to move into some rapid-fire questions. I want to go back to the idea of role models. You had some great thoughts about role models and mentors. And I was curious, do you have a role model yourself?
My role models are everybody fighting to change the status quo, especially every woman all around the world, who refuses to live with the status quo and is determined to change things for all of us. I'm inspired by the people, especially the women I see around me every single day. Those are my role models.
How do you tackle, so you're involved in many different things, so you have a broad range of influence. How do you manage your time? How do you know what you're working on is the most impactful?
First of all, everything I do cross-references. Okay, so my single-minded focus is raising funding for and scaling Make Love Not Porn. And now, as part of that, raising my sex tech fund. Because I'm working on all of that unpaid, alongside that I support myself through paid public speaking and consultancy, but my speaking and my consultancy work gives me the opportunity to feed my own philosophies into many more audiences and many more companies. And that's all I'm doing. And everything is a part of that.
What advice would you, we ask this every guest on a podcast, but also in the event series that we host every month in Berlin. And I was curious what your advice would be to your 14-year-old self.
My advice to my 14-year-old self would be, Cindy, you're not going to want to do this, but the moment that you feel you might be in a position to start working for yourself. I regret nothing in my career, but the only thing I wish is that I'd start working for myself a damn sight sooner.
What advice do you have for people who hear this and say, yeah, I get this, I would love to do that, but the powers at play that keep you in your job, in your the safety of a paycheck, but there's the urge to go and wanting to do their own thing. What advice can you share there to overcome this pull?
So I would recommend to your listeners that they Google Cindy Gallup 3% Conference Closing Keynote 2016. The 3% Conference is a wonderful event that was started by a wonderful woman called Kat Gordon. It's called the 3% Conference because in my industry advertising, 97% of all advertising agency creative directors are men. Only 3% are women. Despite the fact that we are the primary consumers of everything, we are played back to ourselves in advertising through the male gaze. And so I've been keynoting at the 3% Conference for the past 5 years and getting more and more frustrated with the glacial pace of change in my industry. And so my closing keynote last year is titled Women and People of Color, Here's What You Do Next. And what I say in that talk is I want you to be the future of advertising and start your own agency. And I put the word agency in quotation marks because what I say is I don't mean start an agency like all the other agencies you see around you. I mean start your own business, start your own thing. The key thing is you start something that gives you agency. And so my talk to the 3% Conference in 2016 was here are the 10 action points you need to take to start your own business. And they're so simple and easy. You can leave this conference hall tonight. You can begin starting your own business tonight. So that watch that talk. It's all there.
Yeah, it's we'll definitely link it in the show notes. Where do you go for advice?
I have wonderful sources of advice all around me. I have my own network. I have my social network, and I have these days the world of social media and the internet that is a wonderful source of inspiration and advice all the time.
If you could share a piece of advice, career advice, with our listeners, what would be your top three pieces of advice you would share?
Well, the first advice I've already alluded to, but, you know, number one is the only person who can make things happen for you is you. Number two is, number two is to do with the fact that people value you at the value you are seen to put in yourself. I have plenty of advice freely available online on negotiating pay, salary, whatever. And in fact, these days, I also have a chatbot, because for Equal Pay Day this year, the digital agency RGA turned me into CindyBot. So if you go to Facebook and search Ask Cindy Gallup, CindyBot will help you get a pay raise. But if you ask me to distill one piece of advice out of that, it is, you know, a job, for a pay raise, for a project, you should always ask for the highest figure you can say out loud without actually bursting out laughing. And many women have told me they've done that and they got it. And then the third piece of advice is, if you are working somewhere that does not welcome what you uniquely bring to the table, that does not celebrate, champion, value and reward your unique skills, creativity and talents, get the fuck out.
I think that's great advice to end on. Cindy Gallup, thank you very much for coming on a podcast.
It's a pleasure.
Hey, this is David. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Role Models Podcast. If you liked this episode, you can do us a big favor by rating and reviewing this podcast on iTunes, and then to also share the link to this episode with your friends on social media. This will help our Role Models guests get their story heard by more people out there. We appreciate it, and they do too. If you would like to share any feedback with us or ideas for guests we should have on our show, please reach out on Twitter @RoleModels and @David. Thank you.